Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I think you will be delighted tonight. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Tejal Desai. She is a professor of bioengineering and therapeutic science here at UCSF. She's a member of the California Institute for Quantitative Biomedical Research, chair of the UCSF UC Berkeley Graduate Group in Bioengineering, and faculty director of the Masters in Translational Medicine. She did her undergraduate at Brown, go Bruins, yeah. And then her PhD at Berkeley. She's really done incredible stuff. She's won numerous awards, including, wow, some of these awards were amazing. She won the National Science Foundation's New Century Scholar Award and the Faculty Early Career Development Career Award, which recognizes teacher scholars most likely to become the academic leaders of the 21st century. I know her more as Kailash and Serena's mom, so I really was blown away to see what she's done. And the research that she's doing, I think, will keep us all interested, and it's really incredible stuff, nanostructured interfaces of therapeutic delivery. So my pleasure to introduce Dr. Desai.
All right, well, it's a pleasure to be here and be part of this ongoing mini medical school symposium, and thank you for the invitation to speak. So I'm going to talk about some of the things we do. I am an engineer by training, a bioengineer, and I came to UCSF about 6 years ago, really because I wanted to be able to use a lot of the technology that we were developing to actually have medical impact, be able to interface with both the clinical side as well as the basic science side, and think about how we can not just develop new tools but actually use them for medically relevant problems. So just to give you a little context, we're really at a point where we're thinking about therapy or therapeutic delivery in a new way. We no longer think about just giving drugs non-specifically or systemically, although many drugs are still done that way, but really are trying to figure out how we can tailor our therapeutics to be more intelligent, more molecularly targeted, more specific to the diseases that we're trying to solve and trying to cure. Along with this, we're developing delivery platforms, but we're also thinking about this in the context of detection and diagnosis. As we become more predictive and more specific in terms of the technologies on that side, we can also think about how we might want to tailor our delivery of a therapeutic. So enters nanotechnology. And nanotechnology has gotten a lot of hype, both in terms of the scientific community, but also in the mainstream press. And I really divide this into two categories. There's nanotechnology, which really deals in vitro. So using the technology to help us in terms of diagnostic platforms, so things like gene sequencing, what we call lab on a chip, which is taking samples of the patient and being able to figure out what types of diseases they carry or might be able to develop later on. But one of the things that is sort of a newer facet of nanotechnology is actually trying to develop platforms or materials that will actually be used in vivo, so in the body, and be used in a way that can either deliver drugs or deliver cells or facilitate the growth of organs or tissue. And that's really what I'm going to deal with, which is sort of called the therapeutic nanotechnology regime. Why do we care about nanotechnology, nanomaterials? So they're small, which is great, but what does that have to do with biology? How can that actually treat the patient? Well, just from a really simplistic point of view, when we think about nanotechnology, we're thinking about materials that fundamentally have more atoms on the surface. So why is that important? Well, let me give you an example. If we have a nanomaterial, so just a block of atoms at the nanoscale, and you compare that to something that's microscale or macroscale, fundamentally, we just have, by virtue of the size, more atoms that are sitting on the surface. So there's about 51% of that volume is represented at the surface versus something that's a larger material where you only have 4% of the atoms represented on the surface. So that means that as you go smaller, more and more of that material actually is able to interface or be able to interact with the environment. How do we think about that? Well, this is just saying if you have something that's a larger material, you actually have even less and less of the atoms at the surface. So when you have lots of atoms on the surface, that means that you interact more with the environment and you can take cues. You can interact in terms of being triggered by heat, being triggered by cold, light, sound, mechanical cues. Everything that is sort of put into that system now has a magnitude greater effect. That's a very simple way to think about it, but in the context of biology, this really holds true in that when you start to develop materials that interact at that size scale, we no longer interact with the tissue, but now we interact with the cells, with the proteins, with the subcellular components at a very specific scale. So how can we use this for therapeutic applications? Well, it turns out when you start dealing with things at the nanoscale, you can now have control over shape. So we used to think about delivering drugs in a pill or a tablet, and that's really because we could press those powders into a pellet, but we really can't create other shapes. If we actually build up things atom by atom, we can actually control the shape. We can control, of course, the size, as I mentioned, so we can get things that are large, but we can get things that are very small. And one of the things that, of course, we are very interested in, and I'll show you why, is that we can control the interface. We can control what chemistries, what material properties are presented to individual cells. So in a biological context, what this means is now we have a full range of different materials that we can design from. And if you look at what a cell is in terms of nanometers, cells are about 10,000 nanometers in diameter, or 10 microns. But we now have materials that we can design, polymers, liposomes, very small polymeric capsules that are smaller than the size of a cell. We have metal nanoparticles that we can design that are even smaller than that. So they're even smaller than viruses, which are about 10 to 20 nanometers. And we can even take large implants that we think about using in the clinic every day, such as hip implants or stents, and we can put nanoscale features on those implants to impart new biological function. And that's a lot of what we do in our lab. So let me give you just some pictures and then illustrate some specific examples. These are all what we call nanostructured materials. So these are nanowires. So these are very fine pieces of hair, if you will, that we can grow on a surface. And you may think, well, what's the use of that? Well, I'll show you in a moment that the fact that we can grow these nanowires actually allows us to adhere onto things very strongly. And so we can develop targeted therapies that can stick onto specific cells just by using a nanowire architecture. We can create nanopores, so these are nanomembranes, which we also use in the context of therapeutic delivery. Nanoparticles, of course, which are probably the most widely studied nano class of materials. And then you'll see people can make all kinds of things that are useful and not so useful. So here's a nanoscale bunny. Not of any use, but you can do it. But you can also create tubes and other three-dimensional objects. So I want to tell you about two areas that we're really interested in actually applying these types of technologies. One is the delivery of therapeutics, which I'll mainly be talking about. But if there's some time, I'll also talk about the fact that we can use nanoscale materials to actually help to restore implants as well as facilitate the regeneration of tissue. So where are we? This is fiction, which is what I want to start off right at the beginning with. The fact that we are not at a state where we create robots that go through the bloodstream, attack a tumor, and come back and signal the doctor that it's gone. This is what people have depicted as being nanotechnology for drug delivery or therapeutic nanotechnology. But where we are at is the fact that we can create these nanocarriers. These nanocarriers are generally passive, so they don't have active motors that float around, but they are carriers that are at the nanoscale. They have a compartment which can house drug and usually have some molecular target. So that target is able to recognize surface receptors on cells. And we are actively developing those. There are already examples on the market of polymer capsules such as this that are actually being targeted to cancer, for instance, using things like the HER2 receptor for breast cancer. And these are generally containing chemotherapeutic agents that can be targeted. So we have evidence that this can work. Has it been successful for every disease? No, but many people are, of course, trying these concepts where you not only can deliver drug, but you can actually target it to a specific place. I'm going to give you some examples of where we can actually go with micro and nanotechnology that existing technologies can't do within the medical regime. So the first example is actually being able to deliver drugs in a way that doesn't give you delivery over a couple of weeks or a couple of days, but actually can give you delivery of a medicine over many months. And then I'm going to turn our attention to some other applications within the eye as well as in oral delivery. So let's take a look at how drugs are currently being delivered. So if we are on a drug regimen, especially a biologic, for instance, something that may have to be injected, generally we think about having a daily injection or a daily dose or a pill. You get these spikes in terms of how much medicine is in your blood, and this is followed dramatically by this valley where you lose therapeutic efficacy. So you get a lot of drug as you're eating that pill or you're getting that injection, but right away that drug is cleared. So you get these highs and lows in terms of your drug concentration within a body. The reason we often dose is because we want to maintain a therapeutic concentration, and the only way to get into that concentration window is to more frequently dose, given our current technologies. We have some approaches where you can chemically modify a drug. So some people have heard of pegylation, where they can keep the half-life of that drug longer. That allows that drug to actually be administered less frequently, but you can still see from this that you get these highs and lows in terms of efficacy. So a lot of drug is getting in, and then it rapidly comes down. And you have these windows or regions where you have no drug that's in the body. One of the things we've been interested in is there a way to think about using any technology, but specifically nanotechnology, to continuously deliver a drug? So to be able to give an implant and have the drug be given in a very regulated dose over a long period of time. This has actually been something that people have looked at for a long time, for decades, sort of controlled release implant. But one of the things that we really wanted to do is see, can you do this in a way that doesn't give you what's called a burst release? So when you put in a drug within a matrix or a polymer, most of the time the drug gets released very fast because of a concentration difference. And then after a while it equilibrates. And so you get a spike of drug and then it goes down. We wanted to make sure that that drug came out very precisely from day one. So the concept is called zero-order release. Again, if you have a large reservoir and you have drug in it, when that drug diffuses out, this is the type of profile you get. So when I show profiles, what I mean is this is what you would get, the concentration in your blood. So you get a lot out in a short amount of time, and then you start seeing very little come out. And that's why, at this point, you keep having to dose and dose and dose and dose again. When you actually become much smaller, so you get a reservoir that has drug in it, in which the reservoir actually is at the same scale of the actual drug molecule. So let's say you have something like a protein that has a dimension of about 5 nanometers. If you create a little channel that's about that size, now instead of getting this, what we call Fickian release, we start to get release kinetics that look like that. Why is that important? Well, the reason this happens is because if you can imagine, if you're sitting in a crowded theater and there's one exit, it doesn't matter if you have 100 people in that theater or 1,000 people in the theater, the rate of exit of each person is going to be the same. And so we actually take that concept and put that in a very small scale, is that if we can create a very small hole in which the drug is released one molecule at a time, we control very precisely the rate of that drug. If you create a lot of those really small holes, what you then get is the ability to tune that release to any specific amount you want. So what we do is we actually create devices that have very tiny holes in them. These are called nanopores. These pores are individually anywhere from 10 nanometers to 50 nanometers, depending on what we're delivering. And we create large arrays of these pores. We can control the architecture, so we can make them round. We can make them planar, so these are very small, skinny pores. We can do them in many different types of materials. We can put them on three-dimensional objects or implants. And if you have these very controlled pores, what you end up getting is your molecules. For instance, something like this, this is a protein albumin. It has a molecular weight of about 66,000. If you give it in a conventional way, you get this really large burst followed by a plateau. If you put it in these small little nanopores, you start getting what looks like this very linear profile. So the rate that comes out of the device is very controlled. So this is over 70 days. If you think about then putting a drug of interest into something like this, you can use the same amount of drug that may last only 10 days or 20 days and actually extend that out to last 90 days. So this is a phenomenon that's really only specific to the nanoscale. And this just illustrates it again. If you have a very constrained space for molecules to flow through, what you end up getting is that they can only come out in one configuration. And so we can control exactly how those molecules come out. So something as tiny as glucose can actually be constrained in this way. And this illustrates that, that if you have something that's really large, and I say large, but this is 27 nanometers, which is not that large, you can see that you get this rapid release followed by a plateau. But as soon as you bring that channel down to about 7 nanometers, which is approximating the radius of that molecule, you start to get this really linear profile. So let me give you a concrete example of why we care. Usually, those highs and lows in your drug concentration actually result in two things. One, they result in the fact that you have times where you're giving a lot of drug just to stay within a therapeutic window, and that results in both cytotoxicity, so the toxic effects that we see with systemic administration, plus we get a lot of wastage of drug, hence why a lot of therapeutics are extremely expensive. Every time we fall below that therapeutic window, we are underdosing and we're not actually having any biologic effect. And so by staying in this really tight, what we call therapeutic window, we can bypass toxicity and actually extend efficacy. An example that we've been working on is interferon. This is a drug that's given to patients who have hepatitis C. Right now, most people use what's called a pegylated interferon. So this is a stabilized form of this protein that's given every week as an injection. And the cost of treatment is something between $15,000 to $20,000 per year. So it's a very expensive treatment that is actually ongoing multiple years and very difficult to, you basically, once you start taking it, you're on this therapy for a chronic amount of time. And this is how it's usually delivered, either daily or weekly. And again, we want to try to see if we can have one single implant stay in, give that drug, and be able to then be more efficacious. A single device would actually replace over 40 injections, but more importantly, the cost would go down and the efficacy could go up because you're staying within that window. So what do? We take our little nano pores that we can create, and we actually put them onto a membrane. So this is actually a scanning electron microscope image of a silicon membrane. This membrane has very specific pores that are about 20 nanometers wide. We integrate it into a little device that's shown here. This is a titanium tube that has drug, which is basically packed for most of it. So it's mostly drug. But just at the end here, we have these little nano slits. And what we do is we can then insert that under the arm, very much like a Norplant. So those are often used for birth control. But we can then show that we can use this to get, with the same amount of drug, instead of lasting for 7 days, we can actually be within the therapeutic window, for over 3 months. So we're reducing the amount of drug that we use, but we're actually extending this out for the duration of a treatment. Where else could we think about using these sorts of concepts? Well, one area that has gained a lot of attention, particularly because there are many diseases that sort of feed into the underlying causes, is the fact that macular degeneration is becoming a large problem in terms of losing eyesight and becoming blind. So this is a disease where you actually get degeneration of the retinal cells in the back of the eye. And currently, the only treatment is an antibody therapy that is injected either monthly or sometimes every 6 weeks. This is a drug called Lucentis that is often used. And one of the downsides of this, of course, is that you get a needle stuck into your eye every month. But the fact that you actually use a lot of drug to, again, be able to last for that month. So you overdose excessively so that you can get enough drug to be able to stay there for a month, because this drug has a very short half-life. And studies have shown that if you can actually stay within a therapeutic window, you actually can get better visual acuity. So on average, patients come in and get these needles into their eye about 8 times a year. Actually, it should be more, but for somebody to go into the clinic, have a needle put in, somebody has to take time off of work, go into the clinic. Actually, ends up a lot of people aren't compliant with that therapy either. And the peaks and the troughs, so I mentioned those ups and downs, actually lead to poor outcomes. So we are interested in, can we try to create something that can go into the eye and deliver this antibody therapy for not just 1 or 2 months, but at least 6 months, and do this in a one-shot injection. So just to give you a little bit of information about this, the current therapy, it's delivered in this injection. It's about 500 micrograms. But as soon as you inject it, what happens is that the drug breaks down. So what this is showing is drug clearance. And so within about 5 to 10 days, there's actually very little drug left in the eye to do its function. And so for about 2 weeks before you get your next injection, you're sort of what we call naked in terms of being therapeutically dosed. But it turns out from the clinical trials that during that time, you actually start reverting back to your old sort of pre-injection state. And so if you can maintain that therapeutic concentration, you can actually not only prevent further complications, but actually enhance vision or acuity. So what is the unmet need in delivering this? We wanted to create something that would give you this really flat delivery profile that could keep the drug within the therapeutic range. We actually had to think about if you want to put something like that in the eye, and it has to last for 6 months, there's not a lot of space to do that. Some people have had large implants that sit on the outside of the eye and sort of squirt things in. But we really thought, is there a way to use nanotechnology to do this? We wanted it to be a device where you could actually inject it the same way that they do right now, which is in the clinic using a 25-gauge needle. But instead of doing 12 injections a year, you would do it once, and it would sit there. So you actually would not have the patient have to come back for these multiple injections. And then at the end of all of this, actually have the device degrade away. Can we do that? It turns out there are ways that you can do that. And the way we sort of think about it is we can achieve that therapeutic concentration with those fine pores, but now instead of having a permanent device, we need to put this into a biodegradable material. So this is what I'm showing you here. This is a film that's made out of something called polycaprolactone. So it's the same material that sutures are made out of. So sutures degrade. But what we do is we actually cast it in a very thin film, and in that film, we embed these really specific nanoscale channels. So you can sort of see this cloudy region is actually where those channels are. And inside those channels, we embed drug. So what does that do for us? Well, it turns out this film is about 100 microns thick. So a piece of hair is about 100 microns. So think of saran wrap. It has about the consistency of that. And because of that, we can roll it up, put it into a needle, and have it injected the same way that the current drug is being injected in the clinic. The difference is, and I'll show you in a moment, so this is the actual device. And the way we create these little pores in this material is that we actually use what's called a templating approach. So if you think about making a mold or a stamp, what we do is we sort of create really small nanostructures, and then we spin on a polymer that covers these nanostructures, and then we dissolve out the little nanostructures, and what you end up with is a polymer, sort of a flexible mold that now has these little holes, and those holes are defined by the nanostructure. So it gives us really good control over how we put those little nanostructures in. And this is what it looks like. This is the entire film, which has actually this microporous area, because if it was all nanoporous, actually it wouldn't have enough integrity. It would actually fall apart. So we need this to be handled by surgeons, handled by the doctor, and put into a catheter. So it has to have some robustness. But at this really small area, or this top surface, which is about 400 nanometers, embedded are these little nanopores. So this is a flexible membrane. If you saw it, you wouldn't even think it had anything in it. But if you take a really close look at it, it has this little nanoscale architecture. And If we look at what it can deliver, this is out to about 210 days that it's delivering protein, and it's delivering it at a constant rate. So every single day, we get 1 microgram a day of protein that's being delivered from this little device. So we're at about 200 days where we're getting this type of release. We're aiming to see, we're going to see how far we can actually push this. But the film is actually a 4x4 millimeter film that curls up and has this nanostructure. So right now we're looking at these in terms of delivering this antibody therapy. If you put them actually in the eye, what you find is that the eye tolerates this thin film really, really well. And this is a control after injection and 6 months later, and you can really see no differences in terms of the reaction. And this is a film that then at the 6 months actually degrades away. And the reason it does that is that it's made out of a material that undergoes hydrolysis, so it gets broken down by water. But what's interesting is it doesn't actually fall apart until it reaches a critical molecular weight. So it's almost like a sugar cube sitting in water where it has a lot of water coming in, but it still maintains the sort of architecture of the cube until you mix it a little bit and sort of have it swirl around, and then you start to see it disintegrate. And you can actually see the pores. When we don't implant it, even after 6 months, these are the nanopores that are still sitting there being able to deliver. So we're really excited because we think this is a way to deliver therapy in a better way for patients. But the fact that we can use this for not just diseases of the eye, but for any chronic disease where you might want to deliver a protein for, again, not just days or weeks, but actually many, many months at a very regulated rate. So a second example that I want to give you is almost a completely different approach, but again, addressing an unmet need within the delivery area, and that is really having to do with oral drug delivery. So we all think about taking an aspirin or taking oral medications, generally with not much thought about what actually makes it through the intestinal tract into the body. But it turns out even the best case scenario, there's only about 5% of the drug that you take orally that actually make it into the body after being ingested. And that's because we have a gastrointestinal tract that has these epithelial cells. These are cells that line your intestine and your colon, which are actually designed to keep out things. They want to keep out bacteria, they want to keep out pathogens, and so when we ask the intestine to actually take in drugs, we're telling it to do something it's not used to doing. It's easy to get things that are small across that, but anything that's large, like a protein, what the intestine is designed to do is break it down, denature it, and actually then absorb it. So how do we actually get drugs that are effective to cross that barrier? In particular, one area that's been a real challenge is there a way to deliver potent drugs such as chemotherapeutics, as well as some of the more biologic drugs through this oral approach? Because most people, if you ask them, would probably rather take a pill than to have injections or infusions or other therapies. And because actually it's been shown that if you can do an oral dosing, you actually have much higher compliance. So what happens when you give a drug through, if you swallow something? Here's an example of a drug particle. And what happens is that as it flows down the intestine, the particle might be releasing drug, but it is being sort of swept away with all of the peristaltic motion and all the stuff that's flowing down the intestine as well. So imagine it's just a big pipe and a lot of things are coming down. And so if you want drug to actually get across the wall, the best way to do that is to have it stick to the wall such that the drug is right at that interface and can get through. Unfortunately, most times we put a particle, it might make some contact with the wall, but actually it's very quickly washed away as it's going down the intestine. The other thing is that, as I mentioned, this wall is very impermeable. So these cells in the intestine really don't let things get through. They're designed to keep things out. And so how do we get drugs actually to get through, either to attack a cancer or to just get systemic concentrations that are effective? And then how do we actually target it to the region that we want? So again, we sort of were interested in, is there a way to use structure to do this? And the reason that we were interested in this really has to do with the fact that things we know in biology that stick and stick really well actually have a nanostructure on them. So for those of you who are familiar with geckos, those are animals that actually can climb up walls, hang on ceilings, and they do that because if you look at the bottom of their feet, they have these nanoscale setae that sort of stick out on the bottom of their feet, allowing a very, very high surface area. And that surface area creates very strong van der Waal interactions. And that allows them to get very high adhesion in dry environments. And in fact, a lot of animals do this just by having this nanoscale architecture. The beetle has things. Again, this is about 2 micron scale, but as you get to things that have more of the ability to stick onto spider webs, onto various interfaces, you can see they all have this nanoscale projection. So we thought, okay, is there a way to think about this in terms of a biomimetic approach to get things to stick to tissue? So if we want a particle to stick to a specific tissue, can we utilize the fact that we can generate nanostructures on a particle? So we did that, and we created these what we call nanowire-coated particles. So these are, think about a pill that's a fuzzy pill instead of a nice smooth pill. They almost look like little tennis balls. But if you go very close up, what you see is you have these projections, and it turns out these projections are the same size scale as the microvilli that line the cells of your intestine. So all of the cells in your intestine actually have these little projections. Those projections help to absorb food, and they have a lot of projections because it's a very high surface area to get the maximum absorption. Well, if we design our projections to be at the same size scale as these native natural projections that are on our cells, what happens is they interdigitate. And they actually form a very tight interface, which it's very hard to distinguish which ones are the microvilli versus which ones are the ones that we engineer. And if you start to look at this effect from a physical phenomenon, what you find is that these coatings allow these particles to stick onto these intestinal cells at very, very high flow rates. So that's what this is showing, is that you can crank up the shear, so that's the sort of flow, turn on the faucet very, very high, and these particles just stay stuck to these cells. But what's interesting is that it doesn't work with every size. It actually works with a very specific size. And that size is a length of about 2 microns and a diameter of about 20 to 50 nanometers, the exact same size as our native microvilli. When you get too large, you can imagine if you have projections that are way too long, they sort of flop down on each other and they don't interdigitate. If you have things that are too short, you get little interactions, but they don't actually come together like Velcro. So we're really seeing this sort of Velcro effect utilizing engineered materials and biologics. Why is that important? Well, we can get things to stick, and that sticking results in more things able to get through that interface. So I won't go through the details, but what this is showing is that when you have these nanowires, the resistance or the permeability of that interface actually opens up, and it allows more to get through. And so you can see this both with increasing quantities of nanowires, you get more drug getting through. And I'll just skip to this, is that we can load drugs. In this case, we're loading insulin into these nanowire particles. And when we give them to animals, what we see is this remarkable interaction. So this is an animal model where we're giving these particles. So this is actually a dog model where they are basically just eating the particles. We actually label the particles so we can track them. And what we see is that at 15 minutes, all of these particles are sticking to the intestine, able to deliver their drug. At 4 hours, we have no movement of the particles. They're still stuck there. And at 24 hours, we can recover them all out. If you don't have that nanostructure, what happens is that within 15 minutes, all the particles have already gone to the colon. So same particles. The only thing is different is that one has a nanostructure and one doesn't. And what that means is that suddenly in 15 minutes, all of the drug has already gone to the colon and hasn't had the ability to be absorbed. And the absorption always happens most efficiently in the small intestine. So by prolonging the ability of these particles to stick, we're actually allowing the drug to get absorbed. And what this means is that we can get a lot more drug. This is just showing at 1 hour these particles loaded with insulin, such that if you just have particles alone, you get a fairly small amount, but you can double that amount just by tuning the nanostructure. So where do we want to go with this? Well, the fact that you can just use structure to have such a profound difference in how particles travel and how a drug might be absorbed is actually kind of nice, because we're not talking about changing the chemistry. We're not talking about changing the formulation of the drug. All we're doing is we're sort of engineering a little topography or a structure around an existing particle. And it's a physical interaction that doesn't actually go into the body. It is all sort of transited out via normal clearance mechanisms. And finally, as sort of my last example, the next area that is always attractive from a drug delivery perspective is that of transdermal. So if we can deliver things orally, what about through the skin? Patches have been, again, an area that people have really wanted to develop, because if you can put something on the patch and have it absorb through the skin, that's probably even better than taking a pill or doing an injection. And one of the problems with delivering through the skin is that it's actually more of a barrier than even your gastrointestinal tract. So you not only have epithelial cells that line your skin, but you actually have multiple layers of epithelial cells that form a barrier to not just larger proteins, but also form a barrier for moisture, for small ions. Very few things are actually able to penetrate the skin. And the reason that we can develop a transdermal patch for something like nicotine addiction is because nicotine is a very small molecule and it's able to penetrate. But we still can't develop patches for things like insulin or any other larger proteins. So what we do is we are interested, actually working with a company, Kimberly-Clark. So you may be more familiar with them in the context of paper towels. I'm familiar from the diaper side, but they are a company that makes fabrics. And they came to us because they were interested in the fact that if you have a fabric, it's sitting in contact with skin for a long time. And so is there a way we can make the fabric do more than just sort of sit passively on the skin? Wouldn't it be great if we can develop a fabric that can actually deliver therapeutics or be able to augment the function of a lot of the products that we're developing? And they had seen some of our stuff with the nanowire particles, and they said, well, Do you think this would translate into some of the fabrics that we're developing or some of the paper towel products? What if you put a nanostructure? Would that help absorption of some of the therapeutics that we're developing? So we actually started working with them, and we can make all kinds of structures, and I'm just showing you some examples. These are nanostructures, but these are all embedded into flexible polymer sheets, so things that we use or fabrics. So things like polypropylene, polystyrene, we can put them on nylon, we put them on different sort of materials that actually can be manufactured. We, of course, were interested in, and let me just say a few words about how we do that. We actually do that by using what's called a electron beam technology. So we take a film that we're interested in putting a structure in and actually shine and sort of bombard that film with high energy electrons, and that creates a topography into our structure. So here's an example. Here's a film. And on that film, if you take a closer look, we have all these little nanostructures that are formed. It turns out that these films, again, a lot of data here, just the bottom line is that these films also, if you put a nanostructure, allow for things like antibodies and a molecule that we were interested in, which is etanercept. This is a drug for rheumatoid arthritis, to be actually taken up through the skin. And that's important because if you can actually create a bandage or a patch that allows for an antibody therapeutic, especially something for arthritis, that could change a lot of how we treat the disease and also make it easier for the patient. So what happens is actually very similar. The structure goes in and at the nanoscale actually causes these cells to become more permeable. But as soon as you take that structure out, the cells return. And this is a permeability that's not actually something that you feel or you could see on the sort of if you just looked at it. It is a subtle cell reorganization that happens because these cells are interacting with this nanostructure. And so here we have this is epithelial cells, so cells of our skin. When you put the nanostructure on top, suddenly you can see this change in how the cell shape is becoming, so it's sort of ruffling. And then the drug is actually able to penetrate through those openings within the cell. When we lift this back up, it reverts back to this. So it's almost that the structure actually modulates this gate that we have. And there's no chemicals here. It really is just the nanostructure that's doing this. So how are we using this? Well, we're actually putting these nanostructures onto little patches that they're creating. These are microneedle patches. So these are small needles that penetrate only the top surface of your skin. So it actually doesn't go all the way in. It doesn't touch the nerve endings. It only touches that top layer of your skin. And then on each of these little needles, we put this nanostructure on. So you can see it's sort of a very interesting fabrication approach. But fundamentally what happens is that when we use this structure and we look at something like etanercept, we actually can get therapeutic concentrations across the skin. So this is basically showing if you don't have the nanostructure and you use a patch like this, nothing gets across the skin. Once you put that nanostructure on, suddenly you get actual significant therapeutic concentrations. And what's interesting is that we see the drug actually being taken up by the skin and distributed in the way you would if you took an injection of the drug. So again, it's not that we're changing the drug, but we're changing the way the drug is being presented to a biological interface. What's really interesting, just to go along with that, is that that same material just because of its nanostructure, it has less of an immune reaction to it. So oftentimes materials generate scarring around them if you put them in the body. When we take our needles and we put them in the body, what you see is that you get very little scar tissue. And if you don't have the nanostructure, you actually get a lot of scar tissue. So that's that really dark purple. So again, something is in the structure that is allowing cells to remodel without affecting the immunogenicity of that. And it turns out we've looked a little bit at that and seen that a whole cascade of different cytokines, so these are regulatory molecules, actually get changed just by presenting this structure at that scale. And so when we put nanostructures on materials, we downregulate or upregulate certain anti- and pro-inflammatory molecules. And the end result is that if you put a nanostructure onto any implant material, that nanostructure actually mitigates much of the fibrotic fibrous scar tissue that's formed. So I want to end here really just highlighting a couple of things that we think can be valuable in terms of moving forward in this field and actually getting some clinical success. Nanostructure delivery, I believe, and I think some other people believe, can really change the way we sort of look at giving our drugs, not just sort of a one-shot approach, but really being able to tailor both the kinetics, but how those drugs are distributed within the body, and ultimately going for ways that are less invasive and more patient-friendly. But one of the things that I think is important to note is that nanotechnology itself doesn't have to be the answer. You could sort of combine those methods with already the advances that are happening on the biological front and the chemical front to really get what we call multi-additive effects. So combine our control over shape and size with our ability to engineer newer and better therapeutics. And we hope that we'd be able to do this in terms of being able to control the release of multiple drugs in a controlled manner, be able to engineer factories or cellular components that react in a specific way, and ultimately facilitate interactions with the tissue that help to regulate drug uptake. So I want to just acknowledge I have a great group over here at UCSF, but we're over in the Mission Bay campus. And one of the things that has been really fabulous is the fact that as a lot of us with the engineering background being placed in this environment is the fact we now interact with so many different people, and we're constantly being asked to think about different ideas where if we were sitting sort of isolated in the engineering department, we really wouldn't be able to do that. So we're really excited just to be part of what goes on here at UCSF, and also the funding that we receive from many of our collaborators. Thanks so much, and happy to answer any questions. So pharmaceutical companies are very interested, actually, in, well, they're interested in any approach, increasingly, that can be used for their drugs. So there are so many drugs that are being developed, which they get to a state where they've spent a long time developing a drug, but ultimately it fails because either the delivery was inadequate or there was no way to stabilize that drug for long-term chronic use. And so, and even those that are currently being used in the clinic, most pharmaceutical companies realize that the only way to keep that drug alive in the context of new drugs is to think about the delivery. Think about how they can make it more friendly to patients. In terms of being available, some of these technologies actually are already being integrated into existing pharmaceuticals. The examples that I showed are not, in that they're really at the research front. But we are, so we work with folks like Genentech and Pfizer and some other folks actually thinking about their drugs in the context of how the next generation will be developed and how we can utilize it within these types of devices. What is the process? So, I didn't spend a lot of time on this, but actually, so the process is very similar to how they make microelectronic circuits. So we do everything in a clean room, and we actually use photolithography. So this is a process that they use to make silicon chips. But the only thing that we do differently is the fact that instead of using silicon, we are sort of printing structures onto more biocompatible materials or biopolymers. We also use, as I showed, sort of these e-beam technologies, so we can use electron beams to actually print or write down features on these surfaces. And, you know, we do that by creating what we call molds and then mold them off of those to create different structures. Even the nanowire technology, we didn't develop that in the fact that actually for your LED or your flat panel displays that you have at home for any of these high-end television sets, they're actually using that same technology for getting high optical resolution. We're just using that same technology in a completely different context and material. You know, in terms of anti-infective and antibacterial properties, we already use nanoparticles as a effective therapeutic because particles at that dimension actually have ions that are repulsive to bacteria or sort of kill off toxins. So we're already using that in sort of some commercial products. Whether or not, I mean, there are some approaches where you think about using the gold, a gold nanoparticle, heat that up, and that would be the cytotoxic element in terms of generating a local heat. The problem with that approach, or sort of not the problem, but the it's a much further along prospect because ultimately, you need to account for every single nanoparticle doing exactly what you want. And so as you distribute in the body, cells don't actually respond to nanoparticles all in the same way. And so I think what's been difficult is the fact that even if you design your particle, how biology actually interacts with that particle may not be what you predicted. The reason that we've sort of taken an approach where we're taking materials and changing the nanostructure is because ultimately we can go in and retrieve them or we can actually intervene in terms of the therapeutic regimen.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.